This podcast is offered by Jikoji Zen Center on the web at jikoji.org. Our programs are made possible by donations from people like you.
All right. Well, maybe we're beginning to enter the phase of a session where when the teacher is talking about blissfulness and joy, you either think, oh, yeah, totally, or are you kidding? This is hard. My back hurts, or whatever it is. So, yeah, I mean, we get to see the whole of what it can be to be a human just in a small room looking at a wall. And this shows something about how we construct or imagine our experience. And do we have someone here who just arrived?
Is that true?
Hi.
Hello, welcome.
Hi.
What's your name?
Bobby.
Bobby, welcome. Glad you're here.
Thank you.
So, you know, things are of imaginary, dependent, and complete realized nature. And I think I'll just read a little section. Bobby, with all the preceding material, this may just be incredibly baffling, but I hope you enjoy the ride. So I'm going to read a passage from the final chapter of this book. So the book, Vasubandhu's Three Natures, which I wrote, I can't remember if I said this. This is a new translation of Vasubandhu's Treatise on Three Natures, which I did with my translation partner, Wei Jen Teng, who's a professor at Dharma Drum University in Taiwan. And then the book is mostly composed of one chapter of commentary per verse, which I wrote. So there's like really short verses, and then there's basically a 1,000-word essay about each chapter. So the last verse, I'm going to read the last verse, and then I'm going to read a little bit of the commentary. And to be honest, the verses are really hard to understand without quite a bit of instruction. So if you think, what? That's okay. So I titled this chapter, This Very Body for Everyone. And the verse says, through perceiving unlimitedness, accomplishing well-being for self and others, the wise know unsurpassable awakening, the threefold body. It's worthy of note that Vasubandhu, at the end of both of his most well-known texts, the last word or in the last line, it refers to the body. Vasubandhu is associated with a movement generally thought of as mind only. And it's really important to understand that by mind only, we don't mean mind separate from the body or the apparent sensory world, but as what we're pointing to is the body as it is experienced by the mind, not as an object to be manipulated or controlled, but directly the way we experience it. So anyway, here is the comment. I invite you to feel the motion of the belly as the body breathes. Feel your contact with the ground. Feel the sensations in the face. Notice the sensations of the whole body. This text invites us home to where we are embodied. We arrive at the very end of the book and the whole commentary. We arrive at the first foundation of mindfulness, the body. I pray that we may ever deepen our awareness and our sensitivity to the body. May we sense our fingertips on the fur of a cat, a damp breeze on a bitter day, soapy hands on a rough-hewn cup, the pain in our neck, our burning eyes, tears on our cheeks, and the ache of a face that has smiled for hours. The three bodies of Buddha, which is the last line of the text, says, refers to realizing the threefold body. The three bodies of Buddha are an innovation of the Yogacara that we see reflected throughout Mahayana and Vajrayana Buddhism. Nirmanakaya is the manifestation body. It is the physical, temporal body of an incarnate Buddha. Siddhartha Gautama, for example, was a Nirmanakaya. Sambhogakaya is the bliss body. This is the body of a bodhisattva that is characterized by blissful feelings and the ability to bring bliss to others. When someone really understands the imaginary nature, they can choose to live in a world of things, of apparent selves, this world of conflict and loss, and experience it as bliss. They can exist within interdependence without being caught by the idea that there are things to control. By being joyful, they help others realize this joy. Dharmakaya, the third body, is the Dharma body. It is the complete realized nature of the body, which means it has no self nature. It is empty of separation and duration. Thus, the Dharmakaya can't, by definition, be separate from anything. So it is always everywhere. This is why your body is the Buddha, and your body is the universe, and your body is not a thing. It is not an object to be held or controlled. So I have no idea how that's landing. You know, it may just be like, what? Or maybe you're like, ah, I've been studying those for years. You know, during the Oryoki meal, we chant to the Nirmanakaya, Siddhartha Gautama, the Sambhogakaya, which is, I can't remember the name that you're using here, and the Dharmakaya. Yeah. So the idea is to point to the fact that this body, as it appears as a separate thing, has value and importance. And it's also inseparable from everything. And so the whole universe shows up in this form and vice versa. And in the middle, the idea that if we really see how things are imaginary and see how dependent things are, we can really show up for people and just enjoy it. And, you know, people do this. It may seem really crazy, but like people, even in the most terrible circumstances, actually show up really joyfully. And you could actually find many examples of people who are not Buddhists, but just since I'm giving a Dharma talk, I'll, you know, Thich Nhat Hanh, people think, oh, he's really wonderful, very peaceful, very joyful, encouraged singing, taught people how to smile. Like, I needed help with that. I did need help with that. I needed like instructions. So I was so angry and sad and ashamed. Wow. But I mean, Thich Nhat Hanh is a person who was exiled from his home country for almost 30 years. And that exile began during a period when the United States was killing millions of people in his country. It's not like he had like an awesome setup. He had an unbelievably horrible and traumatic set of material circumstances. So this is not like when we talk about the ability to be blissful in the midst of suffering, it's not just a like a crazy idea in a book. It's something that people actually do. Now, one of the most important things, though, is to not expect people to do it. That is unreasonable and unkind. But this tradition is about possibility. Four Noble Truths is about possibility, the possibility of liberation. Things seem very limited most of the time, but that's just the way we're imagining the world. The complete realized nature reveals a world that is completely beyond limitation, because it's only mind that makes limitations. So A Chan nun from China, I think 17th century, but I might have the dates wrong, named Shingang, was an influential Buddhist figure and a poet, and had many Dharma heirs who were also wonderful poets, which is kind of fun. And you can find their work in the great book, Daughters of Emptiness, which is translations by Beata Grant of the poems of Chinese nuns. Anyway, Shingang once wrote, "A single meditation cushion and one is completely protected. Earth may crumble, heaven collapse, but here one is at peace. Sacred titles and worldly fame both fade away in the sitting, and the universe assembles on the tip of a feather." I think I'll just recite it again. A single meditation cushion and one is completely protected. Earth may crumble, heaven collapse, but here one is at peace. Sacred titles and worldly fame both fade away in the sitting, and the universe assembles on the tip of a feather. This is an invitation to find some trust and faith during this session. To trust that this is a safe place to let whatever you are be revealed while you're sitting on the cushion and looking at the wall. And, you know, I might look at the wall and some difficult feeling comes up and I go, how can I get rid of that? Or some tendency of mine comes up that I find not admirable. I go, how can I get rid of that? But we can just practice being like, oh, I see you. Oh. This is the imagination that the conditioning of my consciousness is producing right now. So Shingang understands the power of feeling a place of profound safety as a way of being able to put down our defenses against the world. So the mind, according to Yogacara, is conditioned to take the flux of reality that arises dependently, the dependent nature, and try and figure it out so we can get what we want and be safe and be okay and, you know, have some fun. Divides the world up into apparent world of objects and then says, these ones I like, these I don't. How can I get the ones I like? How can I get rid of the ones I don't? It's the basic driver of suffering in Buddhist thought. But the idea of the imaginary nature is to say none of that stuff is absolutely real. And we can learn to trust that things aren't what we think they are, that they're already of complete realized nature, by just practicing sitting here without doing anything, without trying to make something happen or get something or be something else. That involves trust. In order for that to happen, it requires people to feel some sense of safety. Shingang recognizes this, and she's just giving some encouragement. A single meditation cushion and one is completely protected. Earth may crumble, heaven collapse, but here one is at peace. She's just talking about not being tossed around by the apparent phenomenon. Sacred titles and worldly fame both fade away in the sitting. So you have to read a little bit about Shingang's biography to find out that it was really a pain in the butt to be a famous Buddhist teacher. I know nothing about that, but she's like, oh, I got to be the abbot again. I wish I could just go to my hermitage and I got to talk to the donors and everyone's arguing about where to build the stupa for my teacher. Big years of arguments in her personal biographies. So much for perfect realization. So for her, sacred titles and worldly fame, that's like you're getting my kids to school and getting my project done. She's just talking about the kind of stuff that makes up the grind of her life and saying she can sit on the cushion and trust that it's okay to put it all down. And then the universe assembles on the tip of a feather. This is talking about, I hate to do this, but this is a moment where sign language is so beautiful. To see the gesture of the universe assembling on a tip on the feather, emerging from the hands that Carrie is making, and realize how beautiful language is, how beautiful different languages are. Wow. Got a little distracted by how amazing everything is. Anyway, the universe assembles on the tip of a feather. So seeing the dependent nature, how incomprehensibly and completely intimate everything is, and how complete it is in the moment. She's talking about the intersection of seeing the dependent and complete realized natures. In the 30 verses on consciousness only, Vasubandhu says, when the dependent is not seen, then the complete realized nature is not seen. Ultimately, these are one and the same. The dependent nature and the complete realized nature.
Can you repeat the previous sentence?
Probably not. the quote from Vasubandhu, when the dependent nature is not seen, then the complete realized nature is not seen. So normally we're completely caught by the imaginary. It seems so absolutely real. We're like, this is the real stuff. These are the objective realities. And we don't see the totality of relationship. And because we don't see that, we don't see how things are already complete and whole. And we don't see what Buddhists see, which is a world that is only relationship and process. So in the Treatise on Three Natures, Vasubandhu says in verse 31, in understanding how things really are, the three natures are employed together, corresponding respectively with knowing, relinquishment, and attainment. So in understanding how things really are, the three natures are employed together. So we're saying you're not going to escape from the imaginary and get rid of it or destroy it or go away. This is about seeing all these things. The imaginary nature matters. The way the people you're with see the world really matters. It's very evident. The way we see the world is why we have climate change. If we saw the world in a radically different way, we wouldn't be destroying our ecology. And that's true for all other kinds of systems we're engaged in, little small bad dynamics in our families and big cultural harmful systems like anti-Semitism. So anyway, this isn't about escaping. It's about seeing all three, the imaginary, the dependent, and the complete realized nature. So it says, in understanding how things really are, the three natures are employed together, corresponding respectively with knowing, relinquishment, and attainment. Now, this may be a little bit of a tangent, but I like to talk about relationality. So I was translating this text and I was like, okay, I know the terms. I know this means knowing is a good translation of this, relinquishing is a good, I don't remember the Sanskrit, but I'm all good. And then I sat down with my translation partner, and just in passing, Wei Jen said, you know, this corresponds to the first three noble truths, right? And I thought about saying, oh, yes, of course. But the answer was, heck no, I have no idea what you're talking about. So there's just this moment. He'd immersed himself in the text and found something I hadn't ever seen before. And he was like, oh, cool, you know, wow. So then I learned a lot, which I'm going to try and communicate to you in a minute. But then a little while later, one of my other friends who's a Yogacara scholar, Joy Brennan, was corresponding with me about a new paper she had. And it had some really cool stuff in it. But one of the things was this whole thing about how this corresponds to the first three noble truths. And she was like, and I have figured out that this corresponds with the first three noble truths. And I was like, oh yeah, so did Wei Jian in China. So it's all just a process of sharing and kind of puzzling things out and learning. Anyway, what does this mean? In the first discourse of the Buddha, the discourse on setting the wheel of Dharma in motion, the Buddha lays out the first four noble truths, and then he says, I have known suffering. The evidence of his realization is I know suffering, I have relinquished the origin of suffering, and I've attained the end of suffering. Knowing, relinquishment, and attainment. I have known suffering, I've relinquished the causes of suffering, and I've attained non-suffering. So here, we're saying these three natures match up with this. So to really know the imaginary nature is to know suffering. Samsara is a harsh place, man. It's a bummer. It's a bummer. You, even if you're like doing awesome, you're like, sweet, I'm cruising. I've been practicing. I finally off all my psychiatric medications. That was exciting for me. Whatever. Woo, feel really good. Well, then just turn on the news or talk to somebody else. Samsara is really big. Buddhism is about saying that the pattern by which people suffer is vast and epical. It will last far beyond we can know. And that can be a harsh thing to take on. But if we can learn to live with it, then it's like, oh, this is just real. It's okay. We're in this together. And then instead of feeling like, oh, I'm going to get out of this, we realize, oh, I want to be compassionate within it. That is knowing suffering. What did the Buddha's life look like after he had his nirvana? He hung out with people who were suffering all the time. It's just like a record of person after person coming to him and him meeting them and just trying to have some kind of interaction that was beneficial. That's a cool kind of life, to just be able to be with people and hear how they actually are and trying to have an interaction that's beneficial. Pretty good. That's what nirvana apparently is. I mean, whatever mind state it is, the record we have is I attained nirvana, and then that's what he did. I had a little meeting with Alan Sinacchio over at Berkeley Zen Center, and I was joking about really amazing meditation states. And he said, I have no idea what an amazing meditation state means outside of the way someone embodies it. That's the record we have of the Buddha. Knowing, not leaving, really knowing suffering. And it's relinquishment. So he says, I relinquish the causes of suffering. So here, relinquishing the dependent nature. So this is about something comes up in this moment, and it's very quick for me to be like, oh, I want some of that. I was like, this rice is really good. Like, who made this rice? It's like so, it's almost like, is it sticky rice? I don't know. I'm like analyzing it. I got to get some more of that. Wow, it happened really fast. Yeah, but it's possible to just receive the rice and nothing extra. That's really the practice of our yogi, is those moments where I'm not like, which one am I going to get more of? But where it's just the very experiencing of it, nothing extra. So relinquishment doesn't mean like getting rid of or getting away from. It's just that not grabbing onto whatever has arisen right now. Zazen is good for this. You're like, ooh, I got some calm. How can I keep this? Attainment, complete realization, nature corresponds with attainment of realization. Yeah, well, I'm not big on attainment. Soto Zen, trained in Soto Zen. So yeah, go ahead and attain total enlightenment. I encourage you to do that and report back. I will be very happy to sit in the Dzogchen room and hear about it. That's kind of beyond the scope of this conversation. Because the beautiful thing that I can't really get into here is this system of the three natures shows how it is possible to realize the complete realized nature But you really don't have to, because things are already of complete realized nature. So this is why Buddha's instruction on meditation start by saying everything is already complete. And, you know, in the Bukhansa Zengi, it's all about how the way is originally perfect and all pervading. So that's why we should sit. Or to be more specific, later in the Fukanza Zengi, he says, you should know that the true vehicle appears of itself. So from the very beginning, dullness and distraction are struck aside. I found that completely baffling for years and years. And then I realized he just saying, because everything is of complete realized nature, why wouldn't you want to pay attention to it? It's like if an elephant walked in the room, you're like, oh, my attention is focused. Katagiri would talk about this. He said, talked about seeing a moose. Something startled him so much that he was like, everything disappears and it's just moose. The whole, every moment is like that. We just are kind of like caught up by our little imaginary process. So Dogen's, this is like, might be like, in exactly what way is it complete realized nature? Well, you can enjoy that koan. But this is just an encouragement to see how beautiful and mysterious every moment is. How on earth is it happening that this is here? Relinquishment. Not trying to control, not trying to get, not trying to dominate. I write quite a bit in the book about nonviolent movements, about the practice of going directly where the seat of the suffering is and embodying nonviolence there. Knowing, relinquishment, and attainment. And sometimes that's what Zazen is like. You're just in the whole turmoil of your old mind. You just sit down with it and then just don't try and be another layer of control. Just be there with it because you care. Embodying nonviolence. I think I'm going to tell a little story. And then I'm going to see if other people have things to say. So I was leading a retreat somewhere else some time ago. And it was Doksan time. And someone came in and they were super mad, really mad. And they were like, described a situation to me. And they were like, you need to do something about this. And I have to be kind of careful. So it'll sound a little abstract because I'm trying to protect everyone's identity. All right. So this person was like, well, there was person A who was in a place. And then person B kind of pushed them to do something. That was me. I was person B. I was like, hey, you should do this thing. And it was funny. It was funny. It was a funny thing that we thought was funny. And then person C came up. Person B is talking to me. Person C came up and said, you should not do that. That person did not give you consent to mess with them. And we're in a session. And this person B was like, they shouldn't have told me what to do. It's a silent retreat. So you need to go tell them they're not supposed to tell me what to do. I said, oh, okay. So I gave some space for them to tell me how they felt and how they perceived it. And I was like, okay, well, you know, maybe good to just, you know, you can talk to me more about this. I wouldn't talk to them about it at this time, but you could talk about afterwards. We're in a silent retreat. Afterwards, a good time to connect with people and process things and be real. I did not feel the need, given what I had heard, to engage in some process of correction. So then, person C came back and they were like, person B, they're pushing this person around. Well, they weren't pushing him around, but they were doing something. And that was, I think that was inappropriate. I was like, oh, So I listened to them and I said, well, you know, if this is, you know, if this is so much energy that it's not going to work for you in this retreat, maybe we have to meet. But and they're like, no, I think it's okay. I was like, well, afterwards, why don't you take time to talk to the person and just be real about how you're doing? Then person A came back. They didn't know what had happened. They were incredibly upset about a totally unrelated thing and having like a overwhelming trauma response, which is not uncommon on retreats. Stuff comes up and you get so, we practice being so unguarded. And then all the parts of ourselves that are usually suppressed have room to be seen. And so we were able to be together while she just wept. It had nothing to do with this whole other thing that people had going revolving around her. Why am I telling this story? Mostly because, wow, people have differing perspectives, even on the most apparent, immediate, exactly the same circumstance. And you probably already know this. But my training isn't to be like, well, now I need to determine the objective reality about this, but to facilitate a relational process, both relational between me and the people, between themselves and their own inner workings, and if necessary, between all the parties, so people can just make a step forward. So instead of thinking, you know, I think a conventional world is we need to figure out who is right or wrong, and which, you know, that can happen. This was not one of those cases, it's a little more vague. But focus on process, just process. Because this three natures thing says we only have process. There are not objects which we can control or land on. The attainment of realization suggested in the text is just the realizing that things are flux and being able to be cool with that, to be cool with that. Because in that situation with all these people talking to me, the impulse arose to be like, I need to just figure this out and get everyone to get in line. We're trying to be peaceful here. Really? No. So I was like, oh, look at me. I want to get this all figured out so I can be okay. Yeah. And we're like that. Okay, I think that's enough of me just talking uninterruptedly. Thank you all very much for your attention. I think it would be nice to hear other voices. So, yeah, questions of any kind are welcome and reflections are welcome, but it's in a retreat in, you know, with a sizable group, it's nice to just have kind of short reflections. But yeah, it would be nice to just hear what's coming up for you. Oh, nice. I know the feeling. Like, I came to this retreat because I didn't want to talk. That's okay. Yeah. We don't have to, but yeah, go ahead, Doug.
With the first nature of it's all imaginary, what's helpful in me, for me, looking at that is doesn't mean it isn't substantial or have mass or anything. It's just that how we're seeing it, how I'm seeing it, is incomplete. Is that?
Yeah, that's good. Do you want to say more?
No.
Yeah, so definitely the incomplete is a really important thing. So it's like we see things and we ignore a vast array of conditions on which the thing depends. So I'm going to say a lot of things now, if that's okay. I said I was going to talk interruptedly, but so, you know, there's just easy examples we can take. So, for example, you know, if you purchase a phone, this is an example I often use. You purchase a phone, you're like, it's my phone and it's right here. I control it, right? So we think it's a world of objects where there's possession, there's control, all of that. But in order to do that, we have to be ignoring so many impacts that it has both in the past, the impacts that made it. So the entire economic system and all the extraction of things and the way the economic both supports people and oppresses people, all that is part of like this. And likewise, like the downstream impacts of how it will affect your own consciousness to have the phone. Woo-hoo-hoo. I never just sit, look at my phone pointlessly for huge amounts of time. Maybe. And the downstream impacts of contributing to the economy that produced it and so forth. I mean, you can just go on and on. So like you're saying, it's incomplete in that we tend to see each thing in terms of our conditioned way of seeing it in relationship to us and our needs. And this creates a lot of problems, a lot of problems. So definitely. In terms of mass, that's interesting. And I think what this brings up is one of the major challenges. I'm so surprised fewer people want to talk about this, but this is not seem to line up well with materialism. If you think the world is made of like atoms and quarks and all that kind of stuff, and then I'm saying it's imaginary, that's weird. So this system of thought is pretty clear about what it's saying. It's saying that science and all the ideas we have informed by a scientific world view are things that happen within the field of consciousness. They're things that people experience. To put it in the language of Schrodinger, the physicist who won the Nobel Prize, the reason the scientific world picture is met nowhere, the reason the human intellect and consciousness is met nowhere within the scientific world picture is because it is the whole picture. It can't be contained within it as a part. So he's just acknowledging that it's like science is a process that people do, that does effectively describe things and predict them. That the imaginary nature does that too. The whole point of the imaginary nature is that you can have skillful means, that you can look at how things are and make some judgments about how to act in a way that's beneficial. And science can be good for that. Also not so good. I'm pro-vaccine personally, not so pro firearms. You know, so what this does is it makes everything ethical. A materialist worldview imagines a world of absolute objects where you can be ethical or not. The three natures gives a world where everything you do is always ethical. No sentient being is ever doing anything that isn't either conducive to suffering or harm. So that the worldview is designed to remind us that we can actually do something beneficial. And I'll just play with science briefly more using some quotes in the book. Time and space, those seem like absolutely real, don't they? Well, maybe not. You're like, I'm a cool Zen person. I know that's not real. Time and space from Einstein. Time and space are a way that people think. They're not conditions in which we live. I mean, he's a little bit of a woo-woo kind of a guy, but he's also a physicist. So it's like, these teachings affirm the value of science as a practice. And the last thing I'll say is the whole reason science is it doesn't claim absolute truths. The innovation of science was instead of saying there's an absolute truth in the Bible or whatever, there's a process by which we work together to make predictions. So these teachings actually align really well. So, okay, that was a long answer. Thank you. Yeah.
To add on Schrodinger, he actually studied Indian philosophy before he did the quantum research. probably something. The other thing is I like the poem you quoted. I don't know the Chinese version, but there's three things in that sentence, right? There's earth shattered, and I think your translation was like the heaven shattered. But actually, earth shattered, and the other thing typical in Chinese is the space shattered. Mm. So this transit related to your space and time unreal. Mm. So that's really that concept breakdown in the practitioner's mind. So that's actually one of the, I mean, I don't know, it's exactly probably the last stage of the Zen practice. I think there's three hurdles or three like steps, right? You arrive this stage, that second stage, and I think the third stage, whether it's sky or the empty space breakdown, that's the third stage. And the other further thing, the word comes from further right, that is precisely the conscious only or mind only, how the world generates comes from emptiness, right? From emptiness and some thoughts or something came, and then the world comes, right? It comes in your mind.
Thank you. Yeah, earth and heaven, earth and space. It's falling apart. This happens. I remember I went up to my teacher one day and I was just like, is time happening? And he said, time is a concept. Zazen messes with your concepts. That was the whole, you know, the mind states we can experience are quite various. Other thoughts or reflections, questions? Go ahead.
This kind of talk, which is, I mean, it's not, there's, yeah, it's possible to get the thought, what's the point then? Because it's all imagination, or we're just like, you could, I don't think you're not saying it like this, but I mean, I understand that that there's some, there's three natures, right? Not just the imagination. So there's other, but we're sitting here doing what we're doing now, or what we're doing in our lives. We want to feel like there's richness in that. I want to feel like there's richness in that. And I don't think you mean to say that it's a fool's errand that we're doing all that stuff, you know? So you know, this is kind of, you know, a space and time is an illusion. Maybe, but that's what we have to work with. You know, like, so there's kind of, I think we're all here to celebrate good and be good and make good penetrate. We're not just all locked up in a closet somewhere, are we?
Definitely not. Everything is collective. Yeah. So the teaching is saying you're always intimate with everything.
Yeah.
That doesn't sound like being in a closet. No, so that's one of the most basic elements. And then the fact that time and space aren't absolutely real, you know, we keep saying that the imaginary nature matters and we should know it. And we should care about it, and we should care about the suffering there.
Yeah, but you did tell them they should do it. I mean, if you just told me tell someone they should do it is not very convincing. You know?
Oh,
it's like people want to feel the heart of it. They want to feel love for doing it. It's like, oh, you should care. It's okay. I'll do it. You know what I mean? It's you know what I'm saying? I mean, it's like,
do you not feel that?
Well, I'm not saying I don't feel it. I'm just trying to match the philosophy with the engagement of life. You know, what you're saying sounds pretty abstract.
Mm. Yeah, so that's really why I continually return to illustrating the three natures with direct experiences of using them as a way of engaging in things. So to realize things are imaginary is to realize that it really matters how we engage with them, because we are collectively making the world. So people will live or die, they will suffer based on the way we contribute to the well-being of the world.
We're all making a fake world.
I didn't say fake, I said that's imaginary. Imaginary.
We're like, let's contribute to make the fakeness a good place. You know, so,
yes.
You know, I mean, that sounds sort of, that doesn't have, for me, it doesn't have a lot of yay to it. You know, it's like.
Well, I'm sorry to hear that.
There's something missing in it. Hmm.
Yeah. Well, that's okay. It can be missing for you. And not all teachings are for each person.
Yeah.
That's actually one of the main purposes of this teaching, is to remind us that each person's view is distinct. So the kind of thing that will be beneficial for each person is not the same. So yeah, it's beautiful to acknowledge that you're like, I'm just not feeling this. That's cool. You may have to hear a little bit more about it for another day and a half.
Oh, that's all I get.
But the truth is, really, and I'm not kidding, just be like, that's not really my bag. That is cool. That's the whole point. And it may be your bag and you may find something different. It's all cool. So just acknowledging like, oh yeah, this is, what's going on here? And just touching it. Yeah. So thank you for sharing that. I really appreciate it. Yeah, you're definitely not alone. You're probably just the only one who'll say it out loud.
Well, yeah, I'm not saying it's my bag or not my bag. It just, this seems like, some other, like you said, we're in a discussion about it. So.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, I want to just see if other people who haven't spoken want to bring their voices into the room. Yeah, go ahead.
From whom is it called?
Xingang, Xingang, from the book Daughters of Emptiness. So,
sorry, I had one more question if it's okay.
Yeah, sure.
In your abstract or bio, you said that you also care about climate change.
Mm-hmm.
So, and this may be a super long answer for you, but give me the quick spill. How do you apply, or how do you relate the three natures to your interest also in climate change?
Sure. I may conclude our time of talking with a story related to this question. So if you had questions and thoughts looming, they can maybe resume at a later time. And Monica has probably heard some of these stories a lot of times. Oh my gosh, my teacher, Tim Burkett. Monica is my ordained student, so she gets to hear a lot of the same things. Anyway, thank you for being here. Well, I could tell a few stories. I could tell a lot of stories about the three natures related to climate change work. So let me kind of narrow it down. I'll do kind of a couple to tie together. So a couple of years ago, I've been involved in climate change work with multi-faith groups for years. And a couple of years ago, I got invited to be part of organizing a movement that was being led by Indigenous women in northern Minnesota, predominantly Anishinaabe women, to stop the construction of the Line 3 pipeline, because basically from a climate change perspective, fossil fuel infrastructure projects are counterproductive. So I was like, this looks like a really good movement to be involved in. I'm willing to devote quite a bit of energy to this. So a couple stories. One, I went up and we had one of our first organizing meetings. It was called by a woman named Winona LaDuke. And so we're sitting around a fire. It was very cold because it was winter. We were planning to start the campaign in the spring, or she was, and she wanted input and you know, people to bring their folks. And anyway, we're sitting around talking about what we would do for the movement, how we would do the movement planning, which to me is what you do. If you realize things are in imaginary nature, they matter. So you need to take time and be discerning. How do I want to use my energy? This seemed like a good use of my energy. So there we are. And people would start to complain. They'd be like, ah, the sheriff around here is really going to get in the way. He's just a jerk and blah, blah, blah. And then you're like, and we thought we had the governor with us, but he's not backing the movement. So people would start to get into this. And Winona Luke would let people go about 1 minute on this. And then she'd say, okay, great. What are we going to do? What are we going to do? The principal implication of the three natures is to remove our attention from external objects and trying to control things and return it to the fact that we are doing something that has impact because it creates the world we live in. So I was like, all right, Winona Duke knows the three natures. No, the three natures are an explanation for how liberation can work. It's kind of like music theory. You make the music, someone later on goes, oh, let's look at how to analyze this. It's a way of looking at how liberation works, whether you're Buddhist or not. Liberation from suffering. I believe climate change causes suffering. So anyway, there were other similar messages in that movement. But the other thing is, you know, we got up, we had one day where we had a mass nonviolent direct action with several thousand people. So we had a couple days of training. So what this is about is going to the site of where the suffering is being created and putting your body there and being radically nonviolent. This is also the basic message you see in the three natures. To be nonviolent is, again, to withdraw from trying to control or dominate an external object and to give yourself in an embodied way to the possibility of liberation. So, or using the language of bell hooks, I often use engaging in non-domination. It wasn't about conquering the police. There was some language about conquering Enbridge, the pipeline company, but that energy was there, but it wasn't the only energy. So then, hundreds of people got arrested. A bunch of my people were pretty low-level traumatized by police actions. So we had to have meetings to try and heal. And I was able to be there with them, which I'm grateful for. Realizing our dependent nature, being able to know their suffering and not try and control it, not try and get rid of it, not try and alleviate it so I could feel better, but just be there with them. And then they built the pipeline. And the pipeline is now pumping tar sands oil from Canada into Minnesota across Anishinaabe lands, crossing underneath the Mississippi River at three points. And I can't say I'm happy about it. I'm not happy about it. But the truth is, I never thought we'd stop the pipeline. I chose to be a part of the movement because I saw that the movement was based on relational processes that were about being radically nonviolent, about caring for the people within the movement as we went, about building connections, about building a community of love, not about destroying or conquering something. And the leadership of the Anishinaabe women in that movement are what brought me to that energy. Now, I'm not saying you shouldn't also do things that are effective in a conventional sense. That's good to do. But for me, my training in the three natures is what helped me to do that work and not be completely burned out. I'm not like, oh, I won't do another campaign. That sucked. It was horrible. I'm like, I'm ready to go. I'm so grateful to have those relationships and to have had that degree of love and connection with people in service of the land, in service of a deep sense of connection to the earth. Planting seeds for what will be experienced. Imagined, those mean the same thing in this tradition, as a relational process with a complete giving up of the idea that I can control the outcome. It's very freeing. It's very freeing. And I'm like, I could talk about it right now and just smile because I'm happy, because what I feel is love for the people and the earth and for you all. So there's some thoughts on the subject of how the three natures impacts my work with climate change. I appreciate the time of being with you. And I'm going to suggest we start Zazen at 4:30 and just give a slightly longer break for people to take in the trees. I think it's supposed to start at 4:20. We could just start at 4:30. That would be nice. Have a little break, care for your body, let in what the trees are telling us and the running waters. So thank you all.
Thank you for listening to this podcast offered by Jikoji Zen Center. Our Dharma talks are offered free of charge, and this is made possible by the donations we receive. Your support helps us to continue to offer the Dharma. For more information about Jikoji, please visit us on the web at jikoji.org.